Hello, and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. The idea of this podcast was conceived as a way to be able to present content that was developed for the 2020 Dispute Resolution Conference. That conference was unfortunately called off for that plan-crushing pandemic called COVID-19. We are using this podcast format so we don't lose that valuable conference content. Today's topic relates to implicit bias in mediation. We'll talk about how to identify implicit bias in our lives and in the justice system, and you'll discover how to mitigate the influence of implicit bias in mediations and in other organizations in which you are involved. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 7. Our topic is addressing the impact of implicit bias at the interpersonal and institutional level. Joining me today through the magical world of video conferencing are Ronald Tomlinson, Kip Holly, and Kyle Strickland, Esquire. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very
much. Thanks for having us.
Ronald Tomlinson is the Director of Mediation, ADR Services, and the Director of Housing Enforcement for the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. He also serves as the Commission's liaison with the U.S. Department of Housing and Development, aka HUD, working closely with HUD in the administration of housing cases. Good afternoon. Please tell us a little more about your job. You wear two hats at the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. Do those two worlds intersect?
Actually, and thanks for having me here, and I'm so glad to be back and to see you folks, having worked with the other two panelists in the past. But yes, the two jobs that I have, the two hats that I have at the commission, which is housing and also mediation, with the housing aspects that I do, that's dealing with anti-discrimination law with housing based upon Title VII, and then we have a state statute that's 4112, okay? And so you're looking at those protected classes based upon race, color, sex, national origin, familial status. And then with mediation, the beautiful part about mediation is that with our mediators here, we understood that when we started mediation at the agency and the pilot program, that we wanted to have people that had been working in this as investigators and so forth, because that way we were assured that as a mediator, if you had an employment case, which we do as well, if you have a housing case, which we do, if you have a public accommodation case, you're well voiced in that law. So that these two are interchangeable with me, because probably more than 20% of the cases that we have that come in, and probably even greater than that, go to mediation. And in housing, in the arena of housing, those are the cases that generally we have a high probability of resolving those cases, because through mediation, there are a lot more options that you can have to resolve a case compared to an employment case, okay? And so I oversee both of the mediators and the housing folks. I started this back in 2000 and knew absolutely nothing about housing and knew nothing about mediation. And when we started looking at the pilot program, I was then realizing I need to take some mediation courses. And so that's what I did. But you have to be very creative when it comes to a housing case, because oftentimes we come at it from the stance of employment, because we can automatically know what we can do in an employment case to get it mediated. But housing really allows you to be more thought process in doing it is you're looking at remedies that sometimes we don't naturally think about, okay? And then as an agency, when we're doing those cases, we also have public interest that's out there. So there may be some cases that we might say, you know, that case may not go to mediation because there's some real issues that are there that might be impacting other individuals. So it may not be a good case for mediation, because clearly you don't want to end up having a case that's resolved when you realize this entity may impact the lives of many of the people, whether it's employment and or housing.
Now, so you kind of got thrown into the alternative dispute resolution world. Having been in it for a while, what do you think is like the most important skill for somebody who's in alternative dispute resolution, or specifically in housing dispute resolution?
Well, I go back to Stephen Covey, The Seven Habits. And one of those habits, he says, seek first to understand, then to be understood. And so in my thought process over the years of working with mediations, I began to defer back to that book, which I read years ago. And I was like, that's kind of what you have to do as a mediator. You're seeking to understand the two disputants that are there. You're seeking to understand their issues that are there. You're going to do more interactive listening on a scale that you've never done before in a typical conversation, because you know with mediation, it's these underlying issues that would exist, not just the stuff that's on the surface, you know, because we oftentimes think that what you see before you, that you hear, that's all there is. And I wager there's probably 1,000 times more information that's underneath the surface. And you as a mediator, you've got to be able to hear what they're saying, but also hear the things that they're not saying, okay? And once you begin to do that and realize, okay, I need to circle back to that to get that information out, that was the thing that in my mind, that helped me in terms of my mediation. Because you can go through the training to get mediation done and you know those seven steps that you're doing, but you really want to focus on understanding that I need to hear both parties. And I also need to make sure that the other party is hearing what the other party is saying. And so when we're doing these mediations, sometimes I will ask questions of either side purely to make sure that the other party is hearing it. And I think some years ago, in my early years of doing it, I think I had an attorney one time who, after we had broke for a caucus, he had said to me, you know, I thought your questions were really asinine. And he then said to me, after we walked out of the room together, he said, but after a while, he said, I finally understood what you were doing. Because I think he thought that I was asking questions where we clearly know what the answer is, but that's not what you do in mediation. I can't assume what I know what the answer is. I should be asking questions, even if I think I know what the answer is going to be. Mediation calls upon me to put aside what I may be thinking and let them tell the story.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much, Kate.
Next, I'd like to say hello to Kyle Strickland. Kyle, you received a BA in poli-sci from The Ohio State University. Then you received your law degree from a little known institution called Harvard Law School. And there you were the student body president. How did you enjoy your Harvard experience?
Yeah, little known for sure. It was a great experience at Harvard. I mean, got to really interact with amazing peers and colleagues, as well as teachers and administrators. And it was crazy to be able to be in a place where you had people who literally some of my professors had taught both President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, and you had people who were in the same classes as Supreme Court justices. I mean, it was a truly incredible experience to be there. But also one of the great things was that a lot of folks were pretty down to earth. You know, I think for me, you know, growing up here in Columbus, Ohio, going to Ohio State for undergrad, I wasn't really sure what it would be like to go to a place like Harvard. And, you know, there was that kind of elitist type of status that you thought would probably persist. And of course, that does exist. There certainly is a lot of that exists. But, you know, for the most part, a lot of my classmates and colleagues were really down to earth. I mean, a lot of them committed to the work, committed to making the world a better place. And, you know, I think it's interesting because you go to a place like Harvard and then you really get to see what all of your classmates are doing beyond after graduation. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, I think there are some interesting paths that some have chosen and some I'm very supportive of, some that I'm a little more, eyebrow raising of. But you've got folks who, again, anywhere from working obviously within the public sector or big law firms, or even in the White House as press secretaries, one of my classmates, we disagree on many viewpoints, but I think it's interesting to see just where the different paths can take folks. And so, but I had an incredible experience. I mean, but I will say it was obviously incredibly challenging, both academically, but then more so than that, really a lot of when I was student body president was in the midst of a lot of racial tension at Harvard. So, you know, during my time in law school, it was kind of in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement. And then specifically in Cambridge and at Harvard, There was a discussion about the legacy of slavery at Harvard. And the reason being is because the Harvard Law School shield, it actually had the family crest of Isaac Royal, who it came to light was this brutal slave owner. And so as a result, they wanted students pushed and activists pushed for the removal of the Harvard Law shield and that insignia. And so ultimately, we went through a whole kind of year-long process, had to go through the Board of Trustees, had to go through student debates and engagements and opportunities where you had the multiple sides that said, well, you know, we want to preserve history. And others were saying, no, we need to make sure that that type of symbolism is removed from today's age. And so a lot of turmoil, a lot of conflict, and a lot of attention during that moment. And I had to work with the administration at a time when not a lot of folks wanted to work with the administration, but also having to be representative of diverse student voices. And, you know, ultimately, Harvard Law now does not have that shield, much to their credit. And they removed that specific shield from their symbol. And so, you know, but so much has happened, but it all highlights all the conversations around race in this country and how really there's so many tensions around this because so many people tiptoe around these issues. They don't want to talk about the uncomfortable issues, have the uncomfortable conversations, but we need to lean in and to go to a place, obviously like Ohio State, which opened doors of opportunities for me to go to a place like Harvard, but then to be back home here in Columbus is really an opportunity for us to speak truth to power, to talk about these issues, not be afraid of uncomfortable conversations, and to fight for justice and equality. And so that's what I'm here to do at Kerwin and here in Columbus. And I'm just excited to be here for the conversation.
And speaking of interesting paths, you are the senior legal research analyst at Ohio State's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Kerwin Institute and its mission?
Of course. So the Kerwin Institute is a research-based center at Ohio State University. It was founded in 2003. So we've been around for about 15 or now 17 years or so. And Kerwin Institute, and Kip will be able to tell you a little bit more because he's been there longer than I have, but the Kerwin Institute itself is really, how do we utilize research to look at the issues around race, ethnicity, but also things like unconscious bias, implicit bias. So obviously the topic of today's discussion, as well as how can we take that and apply it into the real world? So looking at things like structural racism and systemic racism and seeing the various approaches and ideologies behind how these issues permeate to where we are today. So it's an interdisciplinary place. So I'm, you know, the lone attorney there. But we have people who are in, you know, psychology, we have social work, we have all sorts of backgrounds where people are from and have that background in. And really it's to come at things with a research lens. So looking at things both through research, traditional, you know, literature reviews and academic research publications, as well as through policy and community engagement. The community engagement side is really what brought me to Kerwin, is I wanted to figure out ways in which to do some of that policy work on the legal level. How do we look at the history of our laws and our policies to where we are today? But then also, how do you actually help others navigate through all these different systems? And so it's been an incredible experience to be able to gain some language and understanding about our country's history around race and racism. But then also even more broadly than that, how do we actually engage people every day and really have conversations with them about how these policies impact their lives and what it is that we can do to empower more communities with the resources, with the tools to address some of these challenges and barriers. And so that's why I'm grateful to be able to learn and lean on colleagues like Kip, because Kip has such a lens of not just being able to engage with community, but then also to recognize all the various different power dynamics, right? So you can't just say that we're going to have a civic engagement meeting and we're going to have a civic association meeting. We're going to have everybody talk to the mayor, talk to, you know, city council, and then not to be able to address power dynamics and why that's so critical, because oftentimes there's this idea that, oh, well, you know, we have our transparency, we have open meetings, anybody can come down to the state house or courthouse to say and speak their mind, and all the opportunities are equal for everybody, when it that ignores all of the different fundamental structures and barriers that make it difficult for people to be engaged in civic society, right? And so how do we actually make sure that those barriers are addressed so that people provide have the resources needed to thrive? And so I'm grateful to be at Kerwin to help do that work, but I'm also grateful to have people like Kip who can help lead us that through that effort as well.
So probably for you and everybody at Kerwin, it's been a big year. So with so much nationwide interest in racial disparity and community issues centered on race, what has this year been like for you professionally?
Of course. So, you know, one of the first things is that, it's personal and professional experience, right? Because there's no way to disconnect yourself from this work as a Black man in America and to be able to see what's happening. And then I think even more broadly than that, everybody, regardless of their background, should know that this is a moment where all of us got to step up. You know, we can't sit on the sidelines. And this is something that I think where we are at right now is something that we have to reckon with. And, you know, one of the things that I think has been particularly interesting is to see how this has played out in the real world, right? So, you know, you talk about all this research that we do. A lot of the focus for a long time has been on things like implicit bias, and we'll talk about that some more, but really the role of individual level thoughts and actions and kind of maintaining discrimination. Like, what are those stereotypes, those unconscious decisions that people have? But then really tying that into something else that was ignored for a long time by the mainstream, which is systemic racism, this idea of that really our country's history, our laws, our policies, and how these things can be, you know, race neutral on its face, but perpetuate inequality and disparities throughout time that give certain benefits to others and ignore and exclude Black and brown and marginalized communities because of the history of race in our country. And more so than all of that is that the real world implications here are just the intensity around anti-Black violence in this country, the police violence, police brutality as an issue, as well as broader societal forces that continue to exclude Black people and their thriving and well-being in this country. And so it's so important for us to stand up to be able to declare Black Lives Matter. That doesn't need to be a political statement. That's a human rights statement. These are issues that we should all stand up for. And ultimately, though, I think one of the things that we're seeing is we've been inundated with requests for trainings and engagements and conversations about race and equity. But one of the things that we think is important is that you can't do this through a one-off training or even two or three trainings. This is a longer-term engagement. And this isn't something that we can only focus on for the summer and then forget about as time goes on. This is an ongoing issue. This is an evolving issue. This is a journey that people are going to have around learning. You know, we're excited about the people who are willing to step up, but this won't be easy. And they're not everybody's just going to come together to say, let's end racism and call for equality in America. We've got a lot of work to do, but it requires folks speaking truth to power.
And I got to give a shout out because Kyle is a seasoned veteran of the Supreme Court Dispute Resolution Conference. He was a presenter back in 2018. How do you keep getting roped into this?
I tell you what, you know, it's cool to be here and now via podcast version. So, you know, however I can serve and be involved, I'm happy to. So I'm excited to be back in this newfound version.
I appreciate that. All right, next I'd like to welcome Kip Holly to our podcast. Kip has a Bachelor's of Science degree in City and Regional Planning from The Ohio State University Knowlton School of Architecture. He also holds an Associate's degree in Geographic Information Systems from Columbus State. And Kip, you also work for the Kerwin Institute and specialize in civic engagement. That topic is so hot right now.
Yeah. It is definitely, I am very busy right now. And, you know, on top of that, another thing that I wasn't able to include on my transcript was I just recently got my Master's of Social Work from The Ohio State University.
So yeah, congrats.
Adding to the tool chest to talk about this pressure topic now that we find ourselves post a very contentious election, an election where race was definitely at the center of that election, and what our country and our community's relationships with race are going to be, and how we're, you know, engaging around that topic, whether it be politically or civically, or in our own communities, even informally. So yeah, it's very, very,
So what are some kind of projects you've been able to work on at the Kerwin Institute?
Oh, so many. So most of my projects in civic engagement have been related to our work with communities through various projects that we've done, whether it be our opportunity mapping, where we've helped communities understand where opportunity is in a community and how that relates to where people are in terms of racial segregation, or in terms of working with community advocates to create a more inclusive engagement environment to talk about structural racism, to talk about implicit bias, and to talk about these barriers for opportunity for Black and Brown people and other people who tend to be marginalized in our community. So for instance, we did a lot of work around the time of the Detroit bankruptcy with organizations in Detroit in sort of crafting new ideals for civic engagement within the city. You know, Detroit, of course, is a very, very big city, and we were working with advocates to sort of bring people, particularly Black and Brown people, at the center of the city that had been sort of closed out of decision-making in communities, closed out of decision-making about development, housing, a lot of downtown development that were going on, and trying to come up with new structures that would sort of start from the bottom up and start from where people were at, start with those natural places of engagement for people living in Detroit, and then empowering those spaces with decision-making power. So those kind of projects were where we kind of started out with. Recently, we've been moving towards doing workshops around our principles of equitable civic engagement, which is kind of our text around how you can create equitable and inclusive civic engagement structures with local governments, with advocates, with nonprofits, in order to sort of take a look at the engagements process that they have now and really being able to evaluate, like, is this bringing people to the table? What are the ingredients that we need to bring people closer to the table? What are some things we need to change internally to make that happen? And how do we do that? And so our work has kind of evolved into that space as well. And recently into doing equity assessment work for different organizations to sort of understand how they are forwarding equity within and without their and throughout their organizations in the community through policies, investments, and internal cultural climate. So it's a lot of different things. And I'm probably only scratching the surface because, like, civic engagement tends to be involved in a little bit of everything that we do. All policies start with who's making those policies. So civic engagement is, and equitable civic engagement is always at the table in that conversation.
And is that how Kerwin typically approaches their work as far as community-based and just focusing on kind of big picture things and then taking it down to a smaller community? How does Kerwin approaches work? I don't want to put words in, you know.
You hit it on the head. A lot of things that we try to do, and Kyle alluded to it earlier, that we're an applied research center. And so it's really about taking information at the academic level, policies at the broader level, and bringing them down to a community focus. And so how are community members, how are, you know, people, you know, who are dealing with these issues of, you know, housing disparity, health disparities, school disparities, implicit bias, structural barriers, how do we take those experiences and map them to these larger sort of academic and policy outcomes and policy in ways that we're talking about policy and really make that connection? And a lot of times what we're really trying to do is take the policy and academics from the abstract and turn them into actual solutions with communities, particularly communities of color who are usually not in that conversation about solutions and creating solutions together. I always like to say that Kerwin is the sort of knowledge partner convener at the table. And it's, we have access to academic and policy knowledge and policy ideals that people don't have access to all the time, but they have access to lived experiences and wisdom and solutions and real world solutions that we don't have access to. And a lot of times Kerwin is the bridge that puts those things together.
I love that. Practical solutions. That makes tons of sense. A term I saw on your website, on the Kerwin website, was structural racialization. I want this podcast to be educational. Can you explain what that term means?
Structural racialization is a term that's been with Kerwin for a long time. Our first executive director, John Powell, really coined that term and popularized it. And it's a really a way of describing how the effect of multiple policies, in multiple areas of our lives, whether that be in housing or in a legal sense, in law and justice, in health, that have been created over a series of years, compound to create racialized structural deficiencies. So when we're talking, it's a good way of sort of describing how sort of housing segregation policies such as redlining, urban renewal, and policies that have gone on since then have all sort of compounded not only to create racialized segregation, but also to create, disparate schooling and education outcomes, disparate health outcomes, and really creates a picture of sort of how these policies have all kind of come together to create these racialized effects.
So we were all set to present about implicit bias at the Dispute Resolution Conference. Are you ready to try that on this new podcast format today?
Let's try it. Let's do what we can.
Yeah.
Dig in. All right. Implicit bias. Kip, you want to give us a working definition and what we need to know about implicit bias?
Yeah, I will start off with a working definition, and I will ask Kyle to fill in the blanks on anything I'm missing. So implicit biases are sort of these unconscious, biases that we hold and that we gather from our lifetime of experiences, that show up in ways that we may not be aware of. So many people who are used to talking about implicit bias now are used to talking about it in terms of race, because that's kind of where we are right now. And these are sort of biases that can manifest in terms of microaggressions or in terms of our decision making, in terms of like housing or, dispute resolution or justice or a number of different ways that are based off of messages that we get around a certain identity or a certain topic. So, in our culture, we have a lot of negative messages when it comes to Blackness that are, filtered through television, radio, upbringing, and everything else. And even if we are explicitly working against racism or explicitly do not identify ourselves as being someone who holds racist ideals, these ideals do seep into our unconscious. They do become part of our decision-making. They do become part of our worldview, even if it's at an unconscious level. And if we are not aware of them or taking steps to mitigate them, they can make a difference in how we approach different people with those identities and decisions about those people with identities.
Kip summed it up pretty well. And it's really one of those things where, one of the ways that a lot of people kind of see it and frame it is really when you think about like stereotypes, the stereotypes that people make about people and identities and kind of backgrounds. But again, one of the important pieces we talk about here is just that the unconscious decision making, right? So you have these split second decisions all into the psychology of how this operates and how this works, because you make shortcuts. And that's how we operate in the world. We make these shortcuts. But the problem is that because they're associative, it doesn't necessarily always align with our explicit intentions, right? So that if you have, repeated exposure to messaging or narratives or these types of stereotypes or your upbringing or whatever it might be, you might believe certain things, just kind of the immediate to it. And you might have these split second judgments without actually believing that. If you kind of step back and think, I don't necessarily believe that per se, I would never want to necessarily have that affect my intentions. But what we really tie in here is why it's important to say, look, even if your intentions don't always align, the problem is the actual outcome. And so you could have meant something entirely different, but if it has a negative and disparate outcome, then that's something we have to address. And so it's one of those things where it is helpful because, And the space around implicit bias is helpful because more and more people are seeing it, recognizing, oh, well, I may not be explicitly, or I may not have explicit judgments about certain people, but we all hold these biases and these stereotypes. And so it's up to us to reflect on them, to learn from them, and to address them so that we don't impact our outcomes and impact our intentions. And ultimately, though, that is why more and more people have really been open to the idea of this conversation. But we need to also talk about explicit biases, which we'll go into. But the implicit bias is critical because we all hold these biases.
And Kyle, I tend to look at this from like a litigation perspective, which is my background, which is how do I prove it? When you're looking at practices that are discriminatory towards races, most of the time you're not going to see explicit proof. Like, we're not going to see a school policy that says we're going to expel Hispanic kids because we don't like them. You know, what kind of things can institutions look at to see if there's probably some implicit bias in play? What are some evidence?
So that's critical, because one of the conversations here is like, well, if it's implicit, then what is the science behind it? What is the evidence behind it? So aside from the fact that there's a tense field around psychology on how this can occur, the question is really that impact and the outcomes. And so really for us is to look at the disparate impact, the disparate outcomes, to see what happens. And that's why it's so important to tie both these biases that people might have on a personal level, but then also with the systemic factors that go into this, because you might hold these biases, but then you have to think about what are the processes that you can take place to mitigate some of these biases so that you don't have disparate outcomes. And so what's important for us is to look at what the outcomes are. So you look at situations like school discipline, for example. You can look at a particular school and see instances and rates of who's getting disciplined at higher rates than other students. And typically what we see right now is Black and Latinx students are disciplined at much higher rates than their white peers, even for similar infractions. And then you even look at the policy side to even look at what are you disciplining these students for? And it tends to be that these situations are largely subjective. And so they're highly subject to biases. And so as a result, if you have these biases that are coloring your decisions that happen to disparately impact certain students over others, then we have to see, well, there's something fundamentally wrong with the way we've been approaching this. And so you look at things like, what are the processes that we can put in place that have less inflection points for bias? So how do you kind of take out some of that opportunities for human error in those particular situations and really put in more actual, less subjective and more objective measures in place? Now, what's important, though, is that we don't just only do objective measures, because we even know, because of the way that our society has been structured with biases, as well as a history of racist policies and racialized society, that even our quote unquote objective measures are biased. That's why you look at things like big data and our algorithms that we do to kind of make decisions or to make calculations around things, where we, even those algorithms, have baked in some of these racial biases. And so as a result, you continue to see disparate outcomes. So the most important thing that we can do is look at the outcomes and see what happened along the pathway to lead to where we are today. This is something that obviously the Supreme Court is wrestling with and has had conversations and task forces around, really to see how is it that we continue to see these disparities within our justice system, where Black and brown people are more likely to be arrested at higher rates, more likely to be locked up longer, more likely to be incarcerated. All of these different factors play a role. And the worst part about it is that they compound upon one another. And so as a result, these policies, these biases become baked in, and you have outcomes that are even harder to unravel in the future. So we have to lean into these issues, and we also have to push back against this idea that it's normalized, because we have normalized the fact that Black and brown communities are overrepresented in categories that measure failure and underrepresented in categories that measure success. We've normalized that. And the reason is because some people believe, well, you know, perhaps that's some sort of behavioral issue or some sort of cultural issue. Maybe that's why, when in fact, the issues are the exploitation and the discrimination and the barriers. And that's the root that we've got to address.
And for Kip and Ronell, is there anything else you want to add as to how implicit bias can impact decision making?
And from the standpoint of the commission, because we do those investigations based upon race, color, national origin, and search religion and disability. And I remember years ago when I would do some training on employment, I started telling the employers that when you were talking about, Kyle, when you're talking about the policies, and I started telling employers that when I was training them, it's that when you start looking at a new policy that you're going to now have disseminated among your workforce, before you do so, I said to them, it's imperative that you look at who is it going to disparately impact. You should be looking at those protected classes, and you should see, okay, how many of these folks are going to be affected in those individual subsets, okay? And I said that if you realize at some point, gosh, there's a lot of women that are impacted by this decision that we're about to put in effect, maybe find something else. Because I said to them, the employees will know. When you put that policy into effect, those who are going to be disparately impacted by it, they will already know. And if you as the employer are not going to be taking those things into consideration, then that's going to lead you to doing something that's going to be disruptive for the workforce, because those individuals, once again, will know. And that's where we get back to the implicit bias, which is I have to be thinking in terms of what I'm doing, what am I saying, and get out of my shell of thinking that, you know, that because we say implicit bias, we're not saying that you are a mean or awful person. It's saying that this is something that you naturally do. And one of the things I used to say early on, as you were talking about stereotypical assumptions, I used to start off my trainings by saying, hey, listen, before I can get to my what I'm doing about anti-discrimination law on housing and public accommodation and employment, let me tell you something, which is it's all about stereotypical assumptions. I said, we have, in the day, I had my long hair with braids and so forth, and I work for the House Civil Rights Commission, and I'm African-American, and I go out to do this training, and much of the audience was Caucasian. And something struck me that made me say to them at that point, which is when I was talking about stereotypical assumptions, I then said, for instance, you all thought something about Ronnell when he walked into the room. And I said, you either thought something positive about me, you might have thought something negative about me, and you might have been just neutral about it. But I said, please do not think for 1 second that you didn't have some thought about me, because that's what we do as humans.
And to go on with that, what stereotypes and implicit biases can affect mediations?
It is across the gamut in terms of just the mediator themselves, because, you know, I would never assume that I as a mediator I don't harbor any implicit biases. And through mediation training, the training that we get, it's not really about letting you understand that you might have such, because over the years of overseeing mediation for the agency for about 20 years, and all of the trainings I was doing, the thing about implicit bias and mediation wasn't one of the things 20, 30 years ago, okay? It was about teaching the mediator, due to the Covey thing, which is listen and try to understand that there's underlying issues. But the mediator themselves could have some implicit biases, because we all do, you know? And so, you know, I've been working with my mediators and having done trainings with other mediators in the Supreme Court. You know, I try to tell people that you have to pretty much be very open-minded. And in that, and when you're dealing with the parties, you got to make sure that the parties are feeling what I call that warm, fuzzy feeling with you. And that feeling that you are really interested in hearing what they got to say, and that you are doing interactive listening, and you're doing it in such a way that you're drawing them in so that they don't start believing that you're really one-sided this way or the other. Because if you're not conscious about that, if you're not conscious about the eye contact, if you're not conscious about all these other things that are going on, the body language of what's happening with the two disputants that are there, if you're not conscious about that, you may be doing something and saying something in such a way that whether you thought it might have been sort of quasi-offensive to the other person or it struck a chord with them, you need to recognize that you can't do those types of things. And you've got to make sure that as you're giving your delivery, talking about the mediation, you know, you make sure you avoid certain words where, you know, they can be this or that. You try to talk about how we're working cooperatively to get this, and you're trying to empower them to get the case resolved, but you're also trying to get them to understand more about each other, not just the issue that was presenting. Because the issue, again, that was just what was presenting is oftentimes not the real root of the problem, okay? We can cure the symptom with an agreement that says we're going to do some training and so forth. But if we don't go any further than that, and then the employer, the housing provider, doesn't go any further, then they're not going to really learn from that. And so I've always told myself, you know, I've got to be really keenly aware of, as I'm beginning to talk and explain the process of mediation, what are they feeling? What can I see peripherally because I'm sitting there at the table at the Apex, what am I seeing peripherally in terms of my delivery? And if I realize that something seems to be a little amiss, be able to change and move and flow with it to make sure that the parties are still there with you and that they're tuned in and that the comfortability level should begin to happen. And if it's not happening, it could be things that you might have said that you just took for granted in terms of explaining. Because to me, my conversation on when I'm doing a mediation is vastly different than the conversation I have when I'm talking with friends. Because I cannot use that same dialogue when I'm talking with friends in a mediation, okay? I have to sort of take this part of Ronell off and set it aside and then transform myself into someone who says that every person in this room has a seat at the table, okay? And as Shirley Chisholm said years ago, that if there's not a seat at the table, then pull in a folding chair. But you've got to make sure that they all feel like that they have a stake here. And if you realize, as you were talking, Kip, about the imbalance of power, oh, that's something in mediation that's always going on, okay? The imbalance of power that exists, and you can see this on the person who comes in, who it may have been their first mediation, they may not have an attorney with them, okay? On the other side, wanting to bring in additional people, you know, and in my mind, you know, sometimes as a mediator, you may be thinking that just because they should all be permitted to bring whoever they want, but you have to realize as soon as that happens in that room, if I'm not aware of the dynamics of what may happen, that if I have males here and I have a female here I'm doing a mediation, and I'm not going to be thinking twice about the fact that there could be this thing of implicit biases in terms of how men and women interact. And I know I did a mediation with a coworker of mine who was a female, and that was one of those times about a decade ago that I really saw the dynamics in the room change greatly because she was a Caucasian female and I was an African-American male. And I was so glad that when we started talking to the parties that I could see through the body language that there were certain people who were gravitating to other folks. And then what I realized was that as an African-American male, if I see the Caucasian female is sort of not that they have to gravitate towards me, but I've got to do something to draw that person in. And there could be something that I may be doing that is making them not feel quite comfortable with me as compared to the female. And in mediation, I want them both to feel comfortable with both of us because that's the role that we play. And when we did our caucuses, we both addressed the fact that when me and Marty got out of the room and we said, gosh, did you realize the dynamics in the room? And we both said, yeah, we both said that was really strange because it wasn't something we had thought about. So over the years of doing the mediations, I've learned that when I do them, if I come out of there and I realize there's been some strange dynamics that I haven't seen before because I've been doing this for years, I then need to go to myself internally and go, what was it that I was doing? What was it that I was saying? Was it my approach? I go back and revisit that because I realize my job as a mediator is to bring them in and there could be some things that I'm doing because just because I'm African-American, I work for the Civil Rights Commission, does not mean that Ronell does not have some implicit biases, okay?
And yeah, I would add probably from the civic engagement world, yeah, that was really, really good. We see a lot of implicit bias in terms of agenda setting, whether that be for public meetings or for some sort of civic engagement initiative. The biases that people are coming with who are empowered to create civic engagement really show through on like how that engagement is structured. And who has the power within that structure or not structure. So agenda setting covers everything by, around what are we going to talk about? How are we going to talk about it? Whose voice is heard? How is that voice heard? Where are we going to meet? And the assumptions about those particular issues usually tell us a lot about the biases that people are kind of coming into that situation with. So if we're using, you know, very sort of academic-y language in an area and we're meeting, say, you know, downtown where there's no bus service or anything like that, if we're talking about a public health challenge or sort of a challenge in terms of safety, in terms of good people and bad people, you can tell that the people who are creating that kind of engagement atmosphere have some assumptions already built in about that community challenge, the community involved, and how challenges get adjudicated and how solutions are come about. that may not fit the reality of the situation. Many of the challenges that we've run into at Kerwin around a lack of civic engagement, access, and power for people of color usually come down to these kind of issues. I mean, there are also structural issues of the fact that there's less money given to engagement activities in communities of color versus communities that are whiter and communities in suburbs. But also, even in situations where there's a control for the money or control for resources, situations of assumptions and power dynamics, who's setting the agenda, who has power to set the agenda, who has power to speak, what are the stories that we're talking about anyway, what are the solutions that are available and who's saying so, often come down to the assumptions held by the people, you know, creating or who are empowered to create the engagement in the first place. And so this is where sort of biases, not only about race, but also biases about class, biases about different neighborhoods, biases about different types of solutions, political biases, all kind of come to play, even when they're not explicit. So somebody can not have be, especially if you're a public administrator, your job, you know, is to be quote unquote objective. But as Kyle alluded to before, our ideals of what objective is are really sort of based in sort of very white normative ideals of engagement, of civic practice, and are not necessarily informed by a growing diverse group of community members. And so if those biases aren't seen, it's really difficult to start a dialogue about what sort of engagement works best for a more diverse community at that point.
I would like to turn now to housing disputes and how race and neighborhood perceptions can impact that. At the Supreme Court, we're doing a lot with online dispute resolution for evictions and foreclosures. They're starting to get pretty bad because of COVID issues and everything. How does the racial composition of a neighborhood impact how individuals perceive it?
Yeah, so one of the things I think is really important, especially the moment we're in, is to talk about, when we talk about systemic racism, when we talk about the disproportionate impacts and disparate impacts of this pandemic in particular, it's critical for us to look at how all these issues impact one another and compound one another. And for us to really address these issues, we have to know that recovery, both on the health end of things, but also the economic side of things, we are going to need to really address these issues in big ways, because otherwise what we're going to see happen is in traditionally situations that happens when it comes to recessions or any sort of downturns, typically Black and brown communities, first fired, last hired. That's what happens as it relates to the situation of recovery. And so even when, quote unquote, things return to normal, it's not going to be normal to a lot of folks. And one of the ways you can sum that up and look at it is through housing. So there's an interesting study that was actually done regarding race and neighborhood perception. So basically the study asks, you know, how does the racial composition of a neighborhood impact how individuals perceive it? So you look at things like, you know, how would you evaluate a neighborhood? You look at things like housing costs, you look at economic opportunity, safety, school quality, property values. All these things would really kind of help you determine whether or not you perceive a neighborhood as, quote, a good neighborhood versus a bad neighborhood. So what they did for this study, they actually had, this study was done where they had white participants and Black participants, and they kind of walked them through comparable neighborhoods and basically asked them, can you rate these neighborhoods on these qualities of school quality, of perceived economic opportunities, perceived property values, all these things, right? The outcomes of this study are particularly alarming, but also highlight the moment we're in, which is that for white participants of this study, simply seeing Black residents in a neighborhood elicited more negative evaluations of the neighborhood conditions, even when all aspects of those neighborhood conditions, except for, you know, race, were comparable between neighborhoods. So this goes in to see how our biases, our perceptions, went to show some participants who may not be explicitly biased, or they might not be, have these, you know, explicit biases, but because of our society, because of these structures, you look at things like concentrated poverty, you look at things like over criminalization of Black and brown communities, then you tend to correlate, well, this neighborhood is more of a predominantly Black neighborhood, or there are more Black residents in a neighborhood. And so perhaps that has to do with the makeup of this neighborhood in terms of its quality. And so as a result, even when these neighborhoods were comparable in rates, you had biases where people thought that, well, this neighborhood, I evaluate it more negatively. And that ties in so much to the conversation around evictions and the conversations around housing, the conversations about, you know, the quote unquote benefits of the doubt that people get or do not get and perceive. And so, of course, Ronell could talk more in terms of situations in terms of disputes that occur. But one of the things that we can see, if you go down to the courthouse here locally here in Franklin County, you see the disparate impact and the disproportionate numbers, typically women of color, maybe single mothers of color, who are having to be in situations where they're getting evicted from their homes. Also, at the same time, have to figure out how they're getting the child care support they need to have, trying to make it to their first or even second or third job, and then still have to somehow make it all the way downtown to address and contest a particular eviction. There are so many different barriers that persist. And unfortunately, because of our racialized narratives, what tends to happen is people believe that the challenges that people are in are somehow the fault of that individual. And as a result, well, they're in this situation, they've got to figure out their way out of it. And so as a result, what happens then is you have these very stringent requirements around these issues, and you don't have a whole lot of room for flexibility in these particular situations. It is an indictment, not on that individual. It is an indictment on a society that allows for these pernicious rates of eviction, the pernicious rates of poverty that occurs time and time again. We have to address these policies. You're not going to be able to continue to keep a roof over your head if you don't have a living wage, if you don't have quality health care and child care to support your needs as a family. And on top of all of that, we are in the midst of a pandemic, and they had a moratorium on evictions for a period of time, and then they stopped. That was a policy decision. There's so much there that we are doing as a society that we must address that deals with racism and these racial perceptions, but also issues more broadly with race and with class and with inequality that we've got to address.
Now, Kyle, I wanted to talk about differential experiences and outcomes. That was something that was included on the slide presentation that you were going to give originally. And I kind of think that's huge just based on my sample size of my Facebook page, honestly. But can you give examples of how differential experiences and outcomes can affect inequity?
Of course. So one of the things that I think is always important when we talk about it, things like implicit bias, that is only one part of the American story of inequity, right? So you might have these biased racial perceptions, as Kip talked about earlier, as Ronell talked about earlier as well, in terms of your individual experiences, how that affects how you see and view other people. But the problem is these biased racial perceptions, it's a cycle of inequity, right? Because you have biased racial perceptions, then you also have differential experiences and access, right? So because of our history of our laws, our policies, our structures, as talked about earlier with residential and racial segregation, what you then tend to see is certain communities are not even given opportunities that others might get. And so as a result, what you tend to see is we have this conversation often in our society, well, every child should have a quality education regardless of zip code. We know that that is not true. Our professed ideals do not match lived reality. And so as a result, some people might not have the same access to schools and to jobs and to opportunity because of a variety of reasons. In some cases, it's a lack of transportation. Other places, a lack of infrastructure, lack of support. And then, of course, because of our society and our history, a lot of that has been because of discriminatory barriers and exclusion. And so as a result, all that ties into this differential experience with structural inequities. And so people are already left behind from the get-go, and that leads to disparate outcomes. And then as a result, what you tend to see then is people in poverty and inequality and despair. And then people then see this cycle and say, well, you see this area of concentrated poverty and you see predominantly Black or brown neighborhood. Then as a result, that must be because of their culture, because of their skin color, because of something wrong with that individual or that group. And so that cycle perpetuates over time. We need to continue to place the emphasis not on individual failings, but on the structures of exclusion and discrimination and exploitation. If we focus on individuals and not systems, we will continue to face poverty and inequality over time, time and time again, and we've got to address that.
And I really hope the listening audience takes the time to look at the PowerPoint slides for this presentation on the Supreme Court of Ohio dispute resolution website, because there is this amazing racial distribution map of Franklin County. And for me, looking at it, I see a really clear line at the 71 highway between predominantly Black and white neighborhoods. And the sad part is that you've also provided maps that show life expectancy and infant mortality. And that line is just as clearly there for worse outcomes in life expectancy and infant mortality right along that same line. And it is striking to see that in action on those maps.
You know, and when I was listening, I was thinking that looking at those maps, that didn't happen by like people just by chance. There were things that were designed, and I remember the stuff with urban renewal as a child, and that freeway came smack dab into the African-American neighborhood, the Hispanic neighborhood. Now, some of these areas we're talking about along 71, you go east of 70, you put in that freeway that's there. So at some point, even in the city of Columbus, where people had access to get from the east side over to here, you cut off the access to where they could not. And I go back and I think about all of this stuff in terms of the structural stuff that existed, the overt stuff, which was if a Black person moved into the neighborhood, the thought process was that the property values were automatically going to drop. Just one Black person moving to the neighborhood, just one person of color moving to the neighborhood. The lending institutions thought the same thing. They had policies that were written that stated this same principle. So over time, I begin to go, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because everyone has the mindset that this is going to happen. And I always tell people, I like to deal with the here and now. What's presenting to me present and the present state. Because that person who's seeking to move into that neighborhood has the money and the means to do so and pay for it and then maintain that house. But you've already decided that because the person was Hispanic or Latino or was not Caucasian, that therefore things are gonna radically change. And then you start thinking about, they may start thinking about, well, who are they going to invite over for rents? Because we've seen housing cases where landlords have been really heavy-handed on African-Americans who are there, and when their African-American friends come by, and when we do those investigations, we're trying to find out, okay, we're not here to represent the charging party or be against the housing provider. But we want to find out is, what did you do with those situations for similarly situated individuals who would not be of that same race, okay? And also understand that the commission, our statute is neutral, okay? Our statute is not about being Black or white or Hispanic, okay? So people perceive us that it's only that, and it's like, no, folks, we're trying to see, how did you treat the folks? And we see instances again and again where you're heavy-handed on someone because of what's presenting. We've had cases where women who are single with their children, where landlords are asking questions about, where's the baby's father? Is the baby's father going to be coming to visit you and all this other stuff? Because you have this preconceived notion that something's going to go awry. And then looking at just males versus females, in our investigations, those questions were not being asked of men. They were only being asked of women. And so it's sort of like when we keep trying to tell people, you have to put aside your stereotypical assumptions of the worst of what that group is and look at it and give that individual person the opportunity, the same opportunity of equality to continue to proceed with it, as opposed to making the assumption that just because this exists.
Yeah, and you know, just to go along back on that highway conversation, it's really a good way of showing how that self-fulfilling prophecy that Ronald talked about plays out in policy, right? Because those highways were placed on land that was already devalued because of redlining maps that based off of racialization at the beginning. And so by the time that those highways were being built, you know, somebody could say in a race neutral way, we're going to put this here because this is land that's not as valuable, when it was already made not valuable by racism beforehand. And that also then translates to a lack of housing value for houses in those areas that we see up until today, which falls into a conversation about disparities in wealth and wealth accumulation over this past century. So you really see how these policies in a structural racialization way build off of one another to create the kind of life experiences and differential life experiences that Kyle was talking about earlier. And so when we get to a dispute resolution or we get to housing and evictions, these are the different experiences that people have been dealing with, not only in their lifetime, but in the lifetime of their parents, grandparents, and so forth, that change the perception of not only housing, but the dispute resolution process altogether.
And Ronelle, let's talk about redlining. What is that? And have you seen that practice in your role as director of housing enforcement at the Ohio Civil Rights Commission?
We've seen it, but not at the level now that we saw 15, 20 years ago. Okay. Because not only has the commission been there, but the Department of Justice has actively worked to sort of make that part go away. But as you well know, once redlining was sort of pushed down, then along came that little thing called predatory lending, where they said that everybody should have a house, okay? And when you looked at those practices of what they were doing, which is, I'm not going to provide the loans and so forth, the lending institutions will not be in those neighborhoods, so we're gonna make it very difficult for you, and we're just gonna determine, because as we said, depending on African-Americans being there and what is the composition, racial composition of the neighborhood, there are things that are there that people are making a determination to devalue the home, okay? But then after that has gone away over those years, it was the predatory lending that happened. And I know it in Columbus that it was the worst in Old Town East, which is where I once lived before. And you're looking at individuals that were then determining that we're going to refi this home, but we're not going to take into account anything about what's going on that really needs to be done. Because not everyone should have a home. And there's no shame, folks, in living in an apartment. You know, this notion that everyone has to be in a home is part of the situation. But what you found on predatory lending was that it was hitting the African-American neighborhoods. It was not hitting at those neighborhoods that where people had higher incomes and higher housing values that were particularly lacking minorities living there. The predatory lenders were not going there. They were going to the depressed neighborhoods. And those who had been living there, who had built up wonderful equity in those homes, were having it stripped away. Because you could look at these the loan files, and as one of my coworkers has said, for Darlene Newman would say, she calls it the thick file and the small file, the thin file. And the Caucasian would get the thin file because we did put you through all these different hoops to eventually get you the loan to refinance. And the African American, Hispanic, Latino, every time they were presenting what they thought they needed, that it would change a little bit more. They needed a little bit more information. They still needed this. They still needed that. And so that's how you were looking at it and going, there's a huge disparity in terms of what you're doing and working with different folks, you know? And we're all familiar with the Long Island study that was done where you saw realtors still doing the same old thing that we thought had disappeared on some level. We thought because we hadn't seen the cases that it wasn't happening, but then you do this test study and realize the things these people were saying as realtors is the same things they were saying back in the 60s and the 50s, you know? And they were steering people away from places because they thought, well, you're Caucasian, you're African American. I think it would be more suitable for you to be over here. And I'm doing that one thing that we talk about again, which is my implicit bias is taking over. And I don't seemingly really understand that what I'm doing is something that is harmful to us as a society by not allowing people to choose where they want to live as opposed to someone else directing them to a certain area that they need to go. But again, to your question, no, we've not seen a whole lot of redlining. It's really evolved into the predatory lending. And I'm hoping and praying we don't get back to redlining to the level that we once were.
All right. And for the mediators out there listening, especially for the ones handling housing mediation, such as the foreclosures and evictions, what's the practical takeaway from learning this background about housing and race?
Well, I think you, you want to think about, you know, that you've got to understand that the person coming into the room, the one who's now about to have the house foreclosed on, the one who's about to be evicted, okay? You need to be able to empathize and understand that just because those notions are, as Kyle was saying, well, they must have done something to get to this point, or they failed to do things by this way, okay? That move away from that and work with that mediation to try to secure that person, that home and that place to stay. Because you cannot get a job in this country or have a decent job without a roof over your head. The housing, the apartment that we live in, that is the foundation for which we all build upon to then be able to move up that ladder. And you know, and I tell people that, you know, when we're doing mediation, if I can prevent them from going to the eviction, because once a person has an eviction on their record, that is something that, well, guess what? When we do an investigation, if that's what they ended up doing, was evicting because you didn't pay the rent, there's not a whole lot I can do unless I say that in that eviction process, I now have to look at the records for all the people you would have evicted. And then I need to see what their race was and what their gender was and so forth, because that's the only way I'm going to get at it to find out if it was really a housing issue where disproportionately the numbers of people that you evicted happen to be people of color. And so that's what we'd have to do with that investigation. But I understand fully. I tell the people that come to this door, please, please never stop paying the rent. If you stop paying the rent for whatever reason, okay, that the landlord didn't fix this or that, don't stop paying the rent because it needs to go into escrow. And then and moving forward with in terms of COVID being here, clearly we don't want to move to this wholesale thing of evicting people, because what are these folks going to be able to do? And ultimately, society as a whole is going to be now having to take care of a situation that has gotten even worse than what it did not have to be. You must have adequate housing. You must have a place to stay. You must have the apartment. So we've got to get over this thing and work with people to keep them there. You know, work through situations to do some sort of a payment thing back. But, you know, we all have to pull back a little bit, because any one of us could be born in that particular station in life. Okay? Any one of us could. Nobody had a choice of who they were going to be, what country they were born in, what neighborhood they were going to be born in, what state they were going to be living in. No one had a choice on that stuff, okay? So we shouldn't be heavy-handed on the person because we're looking at them going, they're minority. So based upon my stereotypical assumptions about who they really are, then therefore I'm not going to really work with this person to figure out a way to keep them there, okay?
Yeah, and I would just add briefly, you know, this highlights just how important it is for policy change. And, you know, it's a, you know, as an individual, whether it's your job as a mediator or not, on an individual level, of course, you have your individual, your person in front of you that you need to make sure you do everything you can to make sure that they're able to stay in their homes and get the protection and security that they need. But we do need to have a conversation that none of us are just on the sideline for this policy conversation, right? I mean, you can use those individual experiences to highlight the need for systemic changes and systematic changes throughout the process. Because the facts are simple. We know the problems. Yeah. We know the challenges. And yet we see continuously inaction on these issues. And not only do we see inaction, we also see vehement opposition to changes. And so as a result, we have a status quo that allows for this inequality, that allows for this despair to continue. And we can't just put this in a silo of like, well, that's over here. We can't address it. We can, but we've got to do the collective will, even for those who aren't typically advocating for policy change, need to figure out ways in which we can do that, because people's lives are on the line. And if we don't do anything, then we are going to continue to see this and we will be complicit in this process. We have been complicit in the inequality that we see today.
And as you say, Kip, 2020 has been a tough year, but hopefully through all this adversity will come some growth. And Kip, what advice do you want to give to courthouse leadership, other people in the judicial system, and just people who are interested in building more equitable communities? How do we start accomplishing that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of different sort of settings, but I think amongst all those settings, going back to this conversation about understanding mitigating power imbalances is huge in this area. We're working and living and making decisions amongst a very inequitable communities, whether that be in terms of how policies play out, in terms of income, in terms of access. The racial inequality that we have in our communities is here. And like Kyle said, we do ourselves no favors by denying it or acting as if it's not the case. So what we can do is, you know, act as if it is the case, recognize that if people are coming in terms of dispute resolution, in terms of wanting to grant justice, that there's already built in power dynamics just in the structure of our justice system, right? And then add to that the power imbalances related to structural racialization that we just talked about earlier, and the different experiences, the different access to opportunity that people are coming with. And more people are vulnerable, particularly people who are Black or Brown in our communities, to sanctions, to having a decision or a assumption go their wrong way. I mean, this could mean the end for somebody, you know, a system or a situation or an encounter that for us, if we're working from a more privileged standpoint, might just be an average day, maybe, you know, make or break for somebody coming into those type of situations. And we need to be able to recognize what that power imbalance does, what that does to having an authentic conversation around those power dynamics, and do what we can to sort of mitigate that, whether it comes to mitigating and understanding our power, our implicit biases before and afterwards, changing our processes to take bias out of the process as much as we can, but also recognizing those diverse experiences and, you know, making those a part of our engagements, making those a part of our conversations and saying, look, you know, I know where we're starting here in terms of what, you know, the kind of situations that we're going through, the kind of conversations that we're going through. And we want to start out with what's most important to you if you have the least voice in the room. So really intentionally changing our engagements to center those who often have the least voices, whether that means changing the agenda, whether that means, changing our policies so that more resources are given to people who are coming into situations who may not have experience or may, be marginalized in other areas, to make sure that they have a powerful voice in the process. All of these are changes that we desperately need to make if we're going to find solutions from lived experiences that are relevant and are really going to move the needle to making sure that everyone has the opportunity to succeed in our communities, and that our society as a whole stays as inclusive and equitable as possible.
And you had some great tips that I saw in your PowerPoint about mitigating power imbalances. And I just wanted to draw attention to them. And I hope people like take notes, because they're really great ideas, which was to be open to shared agenda setting, which is what you said, to let the participants help set that agenda. And also, and this is a huge problem for us in the legal field, using everyday language and explaining wonky terms, all those acronyms, to the people that are part of it, and mediations too. Like, just not using this language that is, you know, a term of art that people go to school for 3 years in Harvard Law School to study, you know, some people pay a ton of money to learn these words. You can't act like everybody off the street gets this stuff. So yeah, I appreciate those as mitigating that power imbalance, because those, just the language itself, can alienate people from the process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know from this end on doing mediations, I always look at some of these agreements that attorneys will draft up. And, you know, there's all of this verbiage and language. And sometimes to me, when it's like an issue of purely differential treatment for someone, you don't need to have this long, long 3-5 page document that I'll essentially says something along the lines of, you know, I'm going to make sure that the heirs of the heirs of the heirs of the heirs. It's like, okay, can we just
run out? That's how we get paid the big bucks, by putting out the page. We get paid by the word.
I'm like, no, because the charging parties will come to us and they'll go, can you tell me what this means? And generally, as you were saying, Kip, because of this thing is so voluminous, they're like looking at it and they are frozen to where they can't even begin to just sort of read it, you know, because it just, they look at it and they go, there's a lot of stuff in here. And I came in with this particular issue here that we're doing the mediation and housing and so forth. And yet you have all these other things that I haven't even thought of that they've included in here. And I don't understand it. And they look to use the mediators to say, explain this to me. Now, I said something earlier that I realized I may not have said that correctly in terms of saying, was that thin file and a thick file, the thin and the thick. The thick file is for the Caucasian person because they will continue to work and they won't take that rigid policy that says this, 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 and this. And if you fall in this category, voila, you get the house. No, they keep working with the Caucasian individuals to find other ways to get them in the house. And it's like, now look, if you're going to do that, then do the same thing for the African-American. Because you're literally making exceptions. I don't like to hear someone say, I got this policy and I can do nothing other than go with that policy. Because in the real world, that is not how it works on any given day.
Well, we're getting to the end of our time for the podcast, but there is a bit that I like to do at the end of all of our Supreme Court Civility and Solutions podcast, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. So there's going to be two questions for the presenters and then one question that they will have for you, the listening audience, as a kind of pop quiz to see if you were paying attention today. So I'll address this to each of our presenters today. What's an interesting and relatively brief mediation-related or community-building story that you would like to share?
Yeah, I'll jump in here. One of the craziest times, as I mentioned, with the situation around Harvard and the symbol, one of the situations was occurring was in the midst of all this discussion about the shield, basically, that really came to light in early 2015. There was an incident where in the Harvard Student Union, you have pictures of all of the past professors at Harvard Law that have always been there throughout the years, hundreds of years. And there was this portrait. And what happened was on this day was somebody, and came to light, somebody actually put black tape over the mouths of only the black professors. And it was a clear indication of just like a hate crime, what's going on, like, it just like clearly trying to silence the broader movement. And so as a result, there was a lot of turmoil around this. And what happened was students kind of came together and said, like, look, we've got to address these issues about racism, inequality at a place like Harvard Law School, and also what the administration needs to do. And so students kind of came together, did a big community engagement meeting, and then they talked about these issues. And then the administration said, we're going to do a meeting. We're going to talk about these issues more broadly. So they held a meeting. And the administration held this meeting in a way in front of the entire student body the student body is about 2,000, but in this event, it was about 600 people that were there, and they were holding this administration, this meeting, and people wanted to speak. Students wanted to talk. They wanted to participate. They wanted to talk about their voices not being heard. Unfortunately, the administration chose that entire time to just speak and not give any time for the students to talk. And so as a result, there was a lot of uproar. And so there was a lot of division for about a few days on campus because the students wanted to speak and talk about issues and the administration wanted the balance, but they didn't want it to be overtaken by the students per se, right? And so there's this big debate about the next community meeting and how that was gonna be structured and what they're gonna do to have the balance between student voice and the administrative voice. So we had to work with student government, we had to work with Harvard's Mediation Center to basically figure out what can we do to kind of navigate this space. And we had a chosen mediator who was trained and was going to be able to facilitate a dialogue with 500 people. I don't know how you do that, but they were ready to do that. However, it started to come to light that students were going to protest this actual community engagement form. And so as a result, what ended up happening was the mediator said, I'm not doing it. They said, I'm not doing it because I know this is going to be set up to fail. And so I'm not doing it. And I said, we need to do this because students need to make their voices heard. They need to express their voices. And at the same time, we need to figure out a way for the administration to make up for that colossal failure before. And so ultimately, administrators in the administration wanted like a faculty member to present. Students wanted a student member to present. And ultimately, the decision, the in-between, was I had to mediate as a student body president at the time to be able to mediate. And the role that I had to play was really timekeeper. It was really trying to be as neutral as I could be. But ultimately, we had this event. There was a lot of intention, a lot of tensions that were leading up to the moment, about 600 plus people. And then, of course, there was a protest at the very beginning of the event. but we had prepared that this was going to happen and students were going to quote unquote take over the event, but we needed to make sure that there was a little bit of controlled chaos and so that not everybody freaked out and the professors didn't get up and leave. And they actually stayed through the moment and somehow was able to mediate and navigate where student voices were able to be heard. Administration was able to say a few words. And then ultimately we were able to end the meeting with a relatively fine ending. And, you know, not everybody was happy with it, but it wasn't a colossal failure that everybody thought it might be. And ultimately, months later, the shield was removed. And so that was one of a lesson in leadership that I was able to see is that you're not going to make everybody happy at the end of the day. You're not going to make everybody happy, but you can put in place structures and understanding to be able to not just say a both sides-ism thing, because this, it needs not to be, and we're having this conversation more broadly about the media environment that we're in. This is not about both sides-ism, right? This is not about that, but this is about how do we make sure that other people can hear the perspectives where folks are coming from and ultimately come towards some solution, knowing that it's not going to be all of the answers as we move forward. And that was a lesson in leadership that I learned through that moment and couldn't have done it without so many people that helped make that process happen.
Thank you. All right, Kip, what do you got for us?
Well, I was thinking of a project that we were doing with some advocates out in California around youth opportunity among Latinx and Hmong children in this community. And, you know, the partner that we had worked with had put together like a super team of people in the area to kind of steer this project. And they were all greatly intentioned and they wanted a youth voice in the proceedings. And so they invited young people to these meetings, and these meetings were all at like a local nonprofit, and it was a boardroom, and it was kind of in the middle of the day, kind of at the end of the day, you know, it was like right after school. And, you know, everybody was talking, you know, and in sort of academic-y program language, and young people were just sitting around like, you know, okay, when's it going to be our turn to speak? You know, the conversation just really wasn't giving them a lot of room for pushback. And, you know, they kind of left. And one of the sort of leaders of this group went out and talked to some of the young people that they invited. And they all agreed to meet the young people on like a Saturday morning at a restaurant. And so it was like two or three of the people from this meeting, young people, and they were like, look, at this meeting, you can say whatever you want to. You don't have to use a language. You don't have to use a filter. Tell us your experiences, yell at us, do whatever you want to. And they did. I think this happened for about 3 weeks straight where they would meet and, you know, the young people were just frustrated. They didn't felt like they were heard. They felt like they were being seen as the bad guy or that people were making decisions for them. And they really had something to say. And the meetings kind of got off to a clunky start. There was a lot of clumsiness. I was at a couple of these meetings and there were a couple times where I was like, oh my God, is this thing going to keep going? But they kept at it. They kept working at it. They finally came up together with an agenda that worked out really well for the young people that were there. And what these three people would do was take like what they heard at these meetings and come back to our regular meetings and they would be the people pushing back on behalf of these young people until eventually, you know, they created a different meeting structure over time, over these different iterations that, you know, was really relevant to both the young people they wanted to have, to the project itself. And it really just, you know, gave everybody this iterative chance to like take a look at the assumptions they had at the table, take a look at the structure that we thought was neutral, but actually wasn't, and change that to match the expectations and the needs of everybody that you wanted at the table. So it was really this sort of like iterative process of what I would love to see people do, this iterative process of, you know, putting a structure out there, being evaluative, being looking, being willing to change, being flexible, and being relevant over and over again until you do get this sort of organic bottom-up engagement process that works really well.
Very cool. All right, Ronnell, you got a story for us?
Well, yes, I do. And I'm going to go more about implicit bias because we had this case against several insurance companies whereby they were not offering total replacement cost insurance to homes that were in the inner city itself, in the neighborhoods. And, you know, this is a case about discrimination. We're going with it with disparate impact. The case makes it, we get the probable cause finding, we issue the formal complaint, it gets to the AG's level, and we now are involved in conciliation, which is a hybrid of mediation because you're working to try to resolve the case. And the thing that was so interesting that came out, which is one of the attorneys told me that worked for the AG's office, was that once, you know, the insurance companies realize, okay, this is what you're going to have to do, which is to offer the product, okay? Just offer the product to the neighborhood, which is what the cases were about, as opposed to saying, we're only going to give you so much, a different type, so it's not total replacement cost. And so when they got to this, the thing that was like bizarre was that they then said, well, but we'll have to charge them more for it. And it was like, didn't you understand? This case is about it's about discrimination. It's about inequality. It's about treating someone differently than the other. And so what we're saying is treat them the same, give them the same product. But we never once said that you'd have to give it to them at a lower rate, which is the assumption that, oh, if they can't afford it, they won't. Well, guess what? They have a choice, okay? This is not about you determining that because it's in those neighborhoods that they may not be able to pay for that type of a premium, but there are going to be some people in there who will be able to, but you've already made the assumption that none of them could. And it was I was like, but you don't understand what the case is about? It's a differential treatment. So we're not saying give it to them for free. Mm-hmm. We select like, charge what you charge the other folks for that product, as opposed to the assumption that the minority individual cannot afford for whatever reason, so forth. It's like, no, we just want you to do it the same way. Give them the opportunity, okay?
Mm-hmm. All right, cool. All right, question two. Who is an amazing person you know who's related to mediation or to civic engagement, and why do you appreciate them?
I'll jump in and say my friend Kwame Christian is fantastic. He's absolutely incredible.
I met him. He is amazing. He's
a very, very skilled negotiator, but then also a really skilled mediator, does incredible work, really kind of thinking through the psychology behind a lot of this work, but then also how to operate in practice. I also had the very great pleasure of working with Kwame because he used to be at the Kerwin Institute, and kind of I came in his role along with Charles Noble. But you know, Kwame Christian is fantastic. He's incredible. I'm sure he has his own podcast, and he is the leader of the American Negotiation Institute. Is fantastic. If you do not know Kwame Christian, check him out. He's incredible. You will learn a lot. I've learned a lot from him. So I love to give him a shout out.
Me too. All right, Kip, who's your shout out?
It was hard. I know so many people, and I'm going to disappoint somebody if they listen to this podcast. I'm going to go.
Boring show. You can't name everybody.
I know. Like for you know, at this moment, even I could name a trillion people. I will probably name Dr. Maurice Stevens at Ohio State University. He's an affiliate professor here at Ohio State. He teaches at the Department of
Comparative Studies.
Comparative studies, yes. Thank you. I was like, I kept wanting to say critical, but it's comparative studies. And Dr. Maurice Stevens is sort of kind of a go-to expert in things like the art of hosting and World Cafe, but really going beyond the lectures to really thinking about how you can use facilitation techniques, how you can use setting, how you can use even the way you ask questions to create a different atmosphere and to create a more inclusive atmosphere, and to even as a facilitator, give yourself a chance to sort of reflect and think about how your facilitation is impacting the space. And I think that that is a great thing that is talked about somewhat outside of race, but he brings a lot of the conversations that we have at Kerwin about race into that larger conversation about how we can change facilitation to be a more organic and empowering experience.
Thank you. I'll have to look him up. Ronell.
I am so glad I didn't have to go first, because in my mind I was like, who? And then all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute. There's a gentleman that's been a law professor for Capitol Law University for a number of years, Floyd Weatherspoon. And when I was in taking law school over there, I was not only a student assistant of his, but I took several courses underneath him. And he was the one who sort of made me realize that there was this other thing that you could be doing, which is some sort of form of alternative dispute resolution, be it mediation, arbitration, and so forth. And I think now going backwards, because that's been long years ago, that still lives with me today, because in the work that I do at the commission, I am more interested in terms of getting the people to sit down and let's work out the situation than I am in terms of the investigation. Because I realize if I could work out that solution through these mechanisms and so forth, then there's going to be a long time that the relationship still exists. Okay. And it was Floyd that was, in terms of the work that he was doing as a professor, that was where he was focused in as well, which was the mediation, the arbitration, all those other things, which is trying to find an equitable solution to the problem that existed.
All right. And then for the last one, give the audience a knowledge check. I'll just, one of you can answer the question. We don't need three pop quizzes. But what is a pop quiz question our audience should be able to answer after listening to the podcast?
I'll jump in and say, structural racialization. So that, you know, define that. I mean, you know, you can
be able
roughly
to pronounce it.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, exactly. You can roughly define what that is. And if you can, then you've done a great job listening throughout this process.
All right. Thank you. All right. Does anyone have any closing words before we sign off today?
Last closing words I'll say is, look, the moment that we're in right now demands all of us to step up beyond the sidelines that we're in. And you know, we have to lean into these issues. Otherwise, nothing will change. And that means not being afraid to talk about race and racism. You know, some people argue that it's divisive to talk about these issues, but I would argue that it's divisive not to talk about these issues, because you're ignoring the lived experiences of so many people, and we've got to lift that up. And it doesn't mean you are an individual bad actor or not. It means that we have to talk about these issues and divisiveness, especially the moment we're in right now and a new world order coming in 2021. There's so much to be done in this country, because race and racism remains a fault line in America. And we've got to lean in, make sure not only we have the language to talk about these issues, but we have the courage and discipline to talk about these issues and to speak truth to power. And so I'm just excited to be part of this conversation today.
You're here. I can't say any better than that.
And the one thing I would add is that, you know, every time you go through these movements like we're doing right now, which is advancing civil rights, the major group that's there, okay, that has had, whether situation has arisen, there's also the other groups that are there. And so while we're pulling this thing on with race, let us not forget gender, because we still live in a nation whereby there's no gender equality in terms of what you pay someone. And to me, I'm sitting here going, why does that still exist today? It's like, and to me, I'm like, you know, this country is a country that says we're a democracy, okay? And that we're the greatest, which we are, okay? But you really have to pause and think about the fact that, guess what? We keep having to pass statutes and legislation to get people to do something. I should not have to always impact your pocketbook for you to be moved to say that you, and you, and all of you in this room and in this audience deserve the same opportunity for equality, okay? Because literally, you know, this thing of the legislation, if you're really looking at this stuff, you should need a legislation to know that you will all deserve that same equal treatment. Okay? And we got to get to not the hearts and the minds of people, but get to the soul of people. If we can somehow go deeper into their soul to get them to do the right thing, much more than saying the hearts and the minds, because we hear people say all the day, hearts and minds is like, and on the plane, I was just like going, I got to go further now, because I've been doing this now for 20 plus years. And I'm one of those that says, I'm not going to keep doing the same thing the same way, and the outcome is going to be the same thing. Okay. So running all along this stretch with all of you folks, and I'm with my panel here, we all are evolving with this as well, because we're realizing what was doing previously, we can't continue to do the same thing. And it now deserves us to do something differently.
Thank you all. That's a wrap for today. Huge thank you to Ronald Tomlinson, Kip Holly, and Kyle Strickland for this presentation and for the work that they do every day. And thank you to you all for listening, especially those of you out there working for justice. I hope that you will join us for our next episode of the Civility and Solutions podcast. Until then, stay healthy.